So last week we were very lucky to have a Venerable Antonio show up spontaneously, as if manifesting from some Buddha realm or something, and teaching us about the Heart Sutra, which was a great opportunity for us all, and especially for me. And so what I'd like to do now is to step, that was a bit sort of an introduction. The Heart Sutra in many ways conveys a lot of the essence and the flavour of Mahayana. What I'd like to do for this lesson is to step backwards a little bit, and from the almost, and the Heart Sutra is almost kind of acidic in its directness, and have a look bit more at some context and try to give some nuance and some idea of the background and so on, what was going on and how this thing that we call Mahayana was formed and what kind of thing that it might be. And as usual, or as I often do, I'd like to use the basic Wikipedia article on Mahayana as a series of lecture notes, which is quite useful. And if we have time, I'd like to have a look at this book here by Paul Williams, Mahayana Buddhism, The Doctrinal Foundations, which is one of the classic texts, probably the classic text in modern scholarly studies on Mahayana. The study of Mahayana has been sort of greatly rehabilitated in recent years in the early period of Buddhism. The Mahayana was criticized, especially by by the German and English Anglo-German scholars, Rhys Davids and Max Müller and so on. And they criticized Mahayana as being kind of late and inauthentic and decadent and so on. And so Mahayana studies were very much out of fashion for quite a long time, and in more recent years have come back into fashion for various reasons. One of the reasons for studying Mahayana, one of the things that's important to understand, of course, is that Mahayana is, a major presence in modern-day Buddhism, and, of course, by far the greatest number of Buddhists today are Mahayana Buddhists, and many people here have practiced within Mahayana monasteries and circles and so on. And so we have to try to find some way of understanding and relating to these kind of different ways of looking at the Dhamma. And of course, if you rely on the sectarian pretensions, then from the Theravadan point of view, then Mahayana is inauthentic, it's a decadence, it's corruption of the suttas, the suttas are false, it's not the real teachings of the Buddha, the Mahayana monastic practice is lax. As one Theravadan monk expressed it, they're no more than disreputable distant cousins of the Theravada. And that phrase was expressed to Bhikkhu Bodhi, and it was expressed by a senior and learned Western Theravadan monk, and it was expressed in the context of a debate on bhikkhuni ordination. Okay, so this is why I wrote the book on sects and sectarianism, is because I understood that much of the opposition, and one of the grounds of the opposition to bhikkhuni ordination in Theravada, was that that many Theravada monks actually think that way, and that for them Mahayana is nothing more than a disreputable second cousin, and is not real Buddhism actually, and so there's no possibility of an actual performance of Sanghakama together or acceptance of a valid ordination lineage. And so these sectarian tenets are greatly influential in how Buddhism is actually practiced within our traditions. And similarly, from the other point of view, just as we have Theravadan fundamentalism, there's a very, very strong strain of Mahayana fundamentalism as well. And so from the Mahayana point of view, the Theravada, or what they call the Hinayana, is narrow, its teachings are shallow, the followers are selfish, they've taken up just a tiny little fragment of the Buddha's teachings and neglected the profound teachings. Mahayana Sutras, one Chinese scholar said that the Mahayana Sutras were like rich, thick cream, while the early Sutras, Hinayana Sutras, were like thin, sour milk. and so on and so forth. And this is a point of view which is very, very strong in a lot of Mahayana teachings and so on, and is found in the texts, and it's found in the Mahayana sutras themselves, and in the various teachers. And of course, both of these sectarian perspectives are wrong. They're not merely wrong, they're stupid. And they're not really merely wrong and stupid, but they're very harmful. And so we should resist them, and we can resist them primarily through knowledge and understanding, and looking at what the trying to get a more realistic picture of what's actually happened. From a fundamentalist point of view, the most terrifying thing, of course, is knowledge. Okay, so within these fundamentalist circles, there will always be a rejection of a realistic and historically based study of religions. Okay, nevertheless, within each of these traditions, we also find a strong counter-movement, and we also find within the Theravada that there are many people who are genuinely sympathetic and accepting and reaching out towards Mahayana, and the same reciprocally within Mahayana schools. So this is, in fact, one of the great problems with sectarianism, is that it pretends that everybody in Theravada or Mahayana or something is basically the same, whereas in fact that's complete hogwash. They're actually very different and full of all kinds of different people with different motivations and so on. And we can't just classify people as belonging to one sect or another. But one of the other problems with the sectarian attitude towards Buddhist studies is that it's right. And that is to say that the Theravadan critique of Mahayana is actually perfectly correct. That actually the Mahayana sutras are in fact late. The monastic practice is in fact decadent. And much of the things which are taught and practiced as being Mahayanist has got nothing to do with Buddhism. And those criticisms are in fact completely correct. The problem is that they're not characteristic of Mahayana, they're exactly characteristic of Theravada as well. And you can find all of those things within Theravada Buddhism just as you can within Mahayana. And the same thing with the Mahayana critique of Theravada is perfectly correct. Lots of Theravadins are very, very narrow-minded. Lots of them don't have any compassion. Lots of them are focused on the very lesser literal interpretations of teachings and don't really understand the profound meaning of things. And that's very true of much of Theravada. Of course, the problem is it's very true of much of Mahayana as well. So when we phrase these critiques in a sectarian form, then we take what can be in part a valid criticism and a valid point for reflection, and we use it in a way which is not very useful, and it becomes a polemical argument back and forth. So rather than taking that kind of point of view, as the Buddha always recommended, neither favouring nor opposing, one should ask and inquire to find out what the situation is. So this is the attitude that we'll take towards the Mahayana. So let's have a look at what Wikipedia says here. Three uses. Mahayana has a living tradition. Mahayana is the larger of the two major traditions of Buddhism existing today, the other being Theravada. This classification is largely undisputed by all Buddhist schools. Okay, so this is in reference to the living, existing situation of Buddhism today. And while that obviously is undisputed, the reality is, the problem is that that classification and representation of things as they are today is assumed to have also pertained in the past, whereas, as we'll see, the situation in the past was often very different. According to the Mahayana method of classification of Buddhist philosophies, Mahayana refers to a level of spiritual motivation, also known as Bodhisattva Jnana. And in fact, Bodhisattva Jnana is really a preferable title, being both more specific and less polemical, the way, literally like the way of the Bodhisattva, but Mahayana has become conventional. According to this classification, the alternative approach is called Hinayana or Shravakayana. Shravaka is misspelled there, but Shravakayana, Mahayana in this sense, is also recognized by Theravada Buddhism, but is not considered very relevant for practice. And when in this perspective is a perspective which is found in the majority of the Mahayana sutras. And just a note, of course, that Hinayana is a very impolite term and is used when the Mahayanas want to abuse the other Buddhists, and Shravakayana is merely a bit condescending, but not actually abusive. So Shravakayana is means the vehicle of the disciples rather than the bodhisattva, the vehicle of the bodhisattvas. So really the polite term, the best term to use for early Buddhist schools taken as a whole is Shravakayana. It's what the Dalai Lama uses. And so that's what when we talk about, like, not just, you know, Sri Lankan Mahavihara Buddhism, as we call Theravada, but the 18 early schools as a whole, Shravakayana is the best term. According to the Vajrayana scheme of classification of practice paths, Mahayana refers to one of the three routes to enlightenment, the other two being Hinayana and Vajrayana. This classification is a teaching of Vajrayana Buddhism and is not recognized by Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism. Of course, Vajrayana Buddhism largely being Buddhism of Tibet. And Vajrayana, the Tibetans acknowledge, is really part of Mahayana. It's not completely distinguished, but has mainly distinguished in terms of having some different philosophy is not really different, but the ways of practice in some ways are different. And this threefold classification, while traditionally here, according to the Vajrayana itself, is classification of three different practice paths, In contemporary Buddhism, we also use the same classification to refer to the three sort of main monastic orders, which is divided. Actually, conventionally we say Theravada, Mahayana and Vajrayana. Actually, what it really is the three Vinaya schools on which these orders are based. So the Theravada based on the Mahavihara Vinaya, the East Asian schools based on the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, and the Tibetan, Bhutanese, Nepalese and Mongolian, and so on, being based on the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. So that's a threefold division, which is more or less a geographical and political division, where those three early schools of Buddhism, the Vinayas, happens to correspond more or less with these schools, although actually the Vinaya school has nothing intrinsically to do with the doctrinal school as such. There's no doctrinal differences in the Vinayas. Okay, although the Mahayana movement traces its origin to Gautama Buddha, scholars believe that it originated in India in the 1st century CE or 1st century BCE. Scholars hold that Mahayana only became a mainstream movement in India in the 5th century CE, since that is when Mahayana's inscriptions started to appear in epigraphic records in India. Before the 11th century CE, so that's 1,000 years after the Buddha, alright? Before the 11th century CE, while Mahayana was still present in India, the Mahayana sutras were still in the process of being revised. Thus, several different versions may have survived of the same sutra. These different versions are invaluable to scholars attempting to reconstruct the history of Mahayana. In the course of its history, Mahayana spread throughout East Asia, the main countries it's practiced today, Tibet, China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and so on. And the main schools, and there's a few schools, Pure Land Zen, Nichiren Buddhism, Shingon, Tibetan Buddhism, and Tendai, these, of course, are all schools that arose in local regions outside of India and are not sort of recognized Indian schools. The question of Indian schools of Mahayana is quite an interesting one, which we might have a look at later. But just to say now that it's generally recognized that there are two main Indian philosophical schools of Mahayana, they being the Madhyamaka, who main exponent, of course, being Nagarjuna, and the what's called the Yogacara, whose main exponent was Vasubandhu, and also Asanga, two brothers. That refers to philosophical schools. Whether that actually related to schools in terms of actually having an organizational center and a functional administrative basis and so on is debatable. And whether indeed the majority of Mahayanists in India had even heard of these philosophical differences which the philosophers debated about is also debatable. Okay, so please everyone interrupt me whenever you feel bored. Yes.
Bored already. Are they contemporaries?
Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu. Vasubandhu was a generation or two later. Yeah, so Vasubandhu, in a sense, was building on or moving on from Nagarjuna's philosophy. Let's say a generation or two. No one can date Nagarjuna to within about 400 years. Yeah, whereas the dates of Wasubandhu are relatively well known. Yeah, Wasubandhu and Asanga were like a generation or two before Buddhaghosa in Sri Lanka. Yeah. The historical source of the name Mahayana is polemical. It had its origin in a debate about what the real teachings of the Buddha were. As such, its use in any context except as that pertaining to a living tradition is controversial among Theravadan practitioners and some scholars. The earliest known mention of Mahayana occurs in the Lotus Sutra between 1st century BCE and 1st century CE. However, some scholars such as Seishi Karashima suggests that a term first used in an early Gandhari Prakrit version of the Lotus Sutra was not Mahayana, but the Prakrit word Mahajana, in the sense of Mahajana, great knowing. At a later stage, when the early Prakrit word was converted to Sanskrit, this Mahajana, being phonetically ambivalent, was mistakenly converted to Mahayana, possibly by contamination arising through proximity to the famous parable of the burning house, which talks of carts, i.e. Yana. So there you are. I mean, that's the kind of thing that scholars love, you know, to say that this whole kind of thing actually just arose out of a linguistic mistake. There's like one monk from Gandhara talking to a monk from Pataliputta, and he didn't quite understand the dialect, so he kind of got it wrong, and they thought he said Mahayana. In fact, he meant great vehicle, he meant great knowledge. So that, well, that kind of thing happens all the time, but so what can we say? Anyway, just a theory. Mahayana Buddhism in India can be divided into two periods, early Mahayana and late Mahayana. It's a complicated system of categories here. The period of early Mahayana Buddhism concerns the origins of Mahayana and the contents of early Mahayana sutras. So this is an area which is, you know, the last 10-20 years has been one of the main areas of scholarly research and shift in certainly in Western scholarship, but I think also in Japanese scholarship on Buddhism. The origins of Mahayana are still not completely understood. Although the Mahayana movement traces its origin to Gautama Buddha, scholars believed, as we said before, in the first century BC or CE. Some other scholars point to evidence Mahayana originated in northwest India in the 1st century CE. Some scholars say Mahayana could have originally developed in the southeast of India, so it's either in the northwest or in the southeast, as a non-monastic tradition. Later it underwent a process of monasticization and emerged in the northwest as a monastic movement. Others say it emerged originally as a monastic movement and so on. Mahayana was first propagated into China by Lokakshema, the first translator of Mahayana into Chinese during the 2nd century CE. So it went to China very quickly, and very often the dates the dates of translation of sutras into Chinese, and they're generally pretty reliable. Chinese had a good historical sense, and they recorded the dates of things within the years of the Chinese dynasties, which are generally fairly well known. So we have concrete evidence and dates on translation of texts into Chinese, which of course, how that actually relates to the period of composition of the text in India is very debatable. But also, it's impossible to tell from that how significant these texts were in ancient India. Many of these texts, you don't have any Indian evidence for them at all. All you have is a Chinese translation date. So we have no idea of how widespread these texts were in India, who was following them, and all of these kinds of things.
Another question would be, with the translation, how long does it sit around here with us to be watching the scriptures?
Well, exactly, yeah. It can be, you know, it's translated in, when we say in China, well, it's actually translated in a monastery in China. It doesn't mean that it's immediately uploaded to the net and everyone in China can read it. It means it's sitting in one monastery, and how many people are reading it. I mean, obviously they did become influential, but yeah, as you say, it's not at all unproblematic how that happened. I mean, it's a bit beside our topic here, but it does seem that Buddhism came into China very piecemeal. Bits and pieces came in different parts geographically, but also different parts would appeal to different strata and kinds of people within Chinese society. So that Buddhism, you sort of didn't appear as a religion as such, but appeared in bits and pieces, and only gradually gained consciousness as a sense of having been a Chinese form of Buddhism. Okay. Three sources of Mahayana. One is the early Buddhist schools, some important Mahayana texts such as Prajna Paramita. Okay, of course the Heart Sutra being the part of the Prajna Paramita literature. Often refer to doctrines associated with the Sarvastivada, which were mentioned or incorporated into Mahayana texts. Okay, and so this in the Heart Sutra starts out with Avalokiteshvara saying that the five skandhas are swabhava shunya. Okay, so that they are empty of swabhava, of inherent existence. And as Venerable Antonio was saying, that this was essentially, this is what the critique was. So to say something's empty doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It means it's empty of this sarvastivada and abhidhamma concept of inherent existence. So it's a dialectical text. In terms of content, however, the Mahayana doctrine is closer to Mahasanghika doctrine is closer to Mahayana thought, particularly those of the sub-schools such as the Lokuttaravadins. I would dispute that. I would say that there are some aspects of Mahasanghika doctrine which are influential, but not necessarily the whole of Mahasanghika doctrine being similar to the whole of Mahayana thought. Biographical literature, the Buddha, so second source, biographical literature, the Buddha composed by people said to have belonged to the vehicle that praised the Buddha. What that means? This literature comprised of Jatakas, Avadanas, and other texts describing the life of the Buddha may have had its origin in various early schools, but developed in ways that transcended the existing sectarian lines and contributed to the rise of Mahayana Buddhism. Buddhist poets wrote their work with purposes different from those of scholars who were concerned with doctrinal issues. And they use literary expressions which transcended doctrinal lines between the schools. So as we've seen, studying briefly, we've had a brief look at the texts of the biographies of the Buddha and so on, and typically in those texts the doctrinal differences are either not found or at least they're fairly minor issues in those. But the main purpose of them is as a devotional and inspiring text. And as such is not primarily concerned with doctrine.
I was just thinking that with sort of as involved in his teachings for the fall of the Buddha, the Buddha didn't teach it by himself much. Better idea sort of was invented by it over time. Mahayana couldn't exist, it was just reached out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, until the Buddha something invented, people would wish the idea.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And that's a very good point. I mean, I think actually, if you look at Mahayana's key Mahayana's teachings, most of them are already found within that later period of the early Buddhist school development. The idea of the paramitas and the developing through the various past lives and the practice of compassion and so on. And so many of these things, not all of the details, but many of them are found there, but they're not sort of crystallized, Mahayana crystallized them all in a way of practice. One of the ways of expressing that difference, which A.K. Water uses, is that in the early schools, the focus is on teaching the life of the Buddha as the Bodhisattva through the Jatakas, which is essentially saying this is what the Buddha did, and which by implication says that this is something we should aspire to. Right? Whereas Mahayana makes that implication very explicit and very central and says, this is definitely what you should aspire to and not to anything less. And so it's that shift in emphasis to really focus on saying that we should be practicing the same way that the Buddha did. So the third source which the claims here, I disagree with this one, but stupa worship, stupas which were initially mere monuments to Gautama Buddha, I would disagree with that, increasingly became places of devotion and of spreading Buddhism to the masses, the majority of whom were illiterate laymen. In the inside of wall of a stupa, pictures were drawn or sculpted depicting the life of a Buddha. This is a bit misleading. When it says the inside wall of a stupa, typically stupas were solid. You couldn't go inside them. But what it means by the wall is you often see the railings around the Buddha, and it's on those railings that they would inscribe the stories. And not the most beautiful example of this kind of thing, although it's done differently there, is in Borobudur. Pictures were drawn or sculpted depicting the life of the Buddha and his previous lives as a Bodhisattva. This has given rise to devotion to the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas, distinct from the purely monastic Sangha of early Buddhist schools. However, this theory has been rejected by a number of scholars, and quite rightly so. Early Mahayanists may well have used the stupas that were not affiliated with the early Buddhist schools as a basis for proselytizing. Yeah, I think that's a complete load of waffle, actually. The fact is that stupas and the worship of stupas is absolutely pervasive and found in every school of Buddhism. The biggest stupas in the world, in fact, the biggest religious monuments of any kind found in the world are in Sri Lanka, and the stupa in the Jetavana is considerably larger than the Great Pyramid. And the greatest number of stupas, I believe, is probably in Pagan in Burma. And so to say that somehow stupa and stupa worship is closely associated with Mahayana, I think has no foundation at all. In fact, Gregory Chopin, in one of his books on Mahayana, I'm tired at the moment, but he argues exactly the opposite, that for the Mahayanists, whereas for the followers of early schools, the stupa was the primary locus of devotion. For Mahayana, the primary locus of devotion was the text. And there's actually a lot of Mahayana sutras which talk about actually worshipping the Mahayana sutras. And so he argues that that showed like a kind of because it's a much more kind of mobile form of shrine. And it didn't require such a massive institutional basis as building great stupas, so they often would worship the text. Interestingly, that you find this emphasis within the Mahayana texts, but you also find in the critique of the Mahayana found within the Sri Lankan text, Sri Lankan Mahavamsa, it talks about the bringing over of a text from India, which is presumably a Mahayana philosophical text, and it says that the king put it on the shrine and worshipped it. Right, so it doesn't mention anything about the king actually reading it and following the teachings of it or anything like that. And that's not the problem. The problem is the fact that you're worshipping this text.
Perhaps the person wrote
which? This is like a theory of Mahayana origins, which was promulgated by certain scholars, but which has largely been criticized in the last several years. Okay. So the commonly expressed misconception that Mahayana started as a lay-inspired movement is based on a selective reading of a very tiny sample of extant Mahayana literature. Okay, so what it's saying outright is a misconception here. In fact, I mean, I agree with it. It is a misconception, but it is the theory which was proposed and very strongly argued for by Hirakawa, who's one of the greatest of the Japanese scholars, and the Japanese scholarly movement in Buddhism have produced far more than all the rest of the world put together. And also Etienne Lamont, who was perhaps the greatest of all Western Buddhist scholars of Buddhism, certainly one of the greatest. So certainly not to be dismissed lightly, and the fact that we can just say so straightforwardly that it's a misconception shows how far the scholarly consensus has shifted in the last 10 to 20 years compared to what it would have been, say, in the 1960s and 1970s. Currently, scholars have moved away from this limited corpus of literature and have started to open up early Mahayana literature, which is very ascetic and expounds the ideal of the monk's life in the forest, which is very interesting, and it seems to hark back. This kind of Mahayana literature seems to hark back to the Agama Sutra's description of actually the Bodhisattva, right? So it's not so much about the Jataka stories and the Bodhisattva in his past lives and so on, but about what Siddhartha Gautama as the Bodhisattva actually practiced. And so when they're saying you should practice like a Bodhisattva, they mean you should practice like Siddhartha Gautama practiced when he left the palace and went off into the forest and meditated. And so some of these sutras, which are Mahayana sutras, they say things like, you know, Bodhisattva should go into the forest, into the secluded border regions where nobody goes, and if anybody approaches them, they should reject them and not have anything to do with them, and the true Mahayanas would never associate with the villagers and would dedicate themselves to seclusion and so on and so forth. And so you find a lot of these kinds of things in some of the early Mahayana sutras. A scholarly consensus about the origin of the Mahayana has not yet been reached, but it has been suggested by the time Mahayana in India became mainstream in the 5th century CE, it had become what it had originally most strongly objected to, a fully landed, sedentary, lay-orientated monastic institution. It's lay-orientated and monastic. I'm not quite sure about that. Anyway, before that, the Mahayana movement may well have been either a marginalized ascetic group of monks living in the forest or a group of conservatives embedded in mainstream socially engaged early Buddhist monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite sure. Who's saying that? Malcontent. Well, groups of... Oh, the original quote here is groups of cantankerous and malcontent conservatives. Wow, cool. All of whom were continued pouring out pamphlets espousing their views and values, pamphlets that we now know as Mahayana Sutras. Cantankerous and malcontent conservatives. Okay.
The early...
Well, yeah, that's one of the things, yeah. They would maybe be managers of stupas,
yeah,
for example.
Rituals,
yeah, forms of rituals and stuff, yeah. Well, exactly, yeah. The monk Lokak Shema translated early Mahayana sutras to Chinese. There's a picture of Lokak Shema. Well, yeah, it says, yeah, he was a monk, yeah. Yeah, I'm here to be.
How did you get the sutras to be Chinese from India?
How, what, sir?
The text that they were translating into Chinese, they have to be some source.
Uh-huh.
So, are they from India?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Or from Greater India, yeah. They might not be from the mainland India. Some came from Sri Lanka. Some came from, like, Afghanistan, Central Asia, and so on.
Actually
Chinese based, but from historical records, it seems that they are all translated from the Indian text, so it definitely originated from India and
from
China. Yeah, certainly all of the main ones did. There's question about some texts, obviously, the sutras of the patriarchs and so on, which were composed in China,
uh-huh.
And there may be some about which there's doubt, but generally speaking, all of the main Mahayana sutras were composed in India. And we have massive amounts of Sanskrit texts of Mahayana sutras, as well, of course, as all of the Tibetan translations of them as well. Yeah. There's only a few. So just one example of one that there may be some doubt about is a thing called the Mahaprajna Paramita Upadesha Shastra, which is a very, very influential shastra or commentary in Chinese Buddhism, and it's basically an extended commentary on, I think, on the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the longer Prajnaparamita Sutra, which the Chinese scholars attribute to Nagarjuna, and it's in the Madhyamaka philosophical style. Now that text is believed in China to have originated in India, but there's no evidence for its actual existence in India. Okay, it's not referred to in any other commentaries in India, it's not found in any Sanskrit version or in any Tibetan version. And yet it's very, very influential as a text in China, so that may well have been a Chinese commentary composed in China. On the other hand, it might not have been. It may have been translated and we've just lost the origins. Yeah. So in some cases, you can discern these things through linguistic study and so on, but it's not easy to find it. Especially, the Buddhist texts are always borrowing from each other anyway. So even if you say something was composed in China, what exactly does that mean? I mean, it probably draws on a lot of other commentaries and texts and so on anyway. So it's not necessarily sort of composed afresh in the sense that we think of composition. I'm not quite sure. Some of the translators were Indian, some were Chinese, like Chema. A lot of them were from like Central Asia. Yeah, he's from Gandhara, Kushan. That's the area from Gandhara.
That's
what. Yeah. Yeah, well, it is interesting. He doesn't look very monastic. That's quite right. But I mean, that's just not a photograph. Anyway. The earliest sutras which show some Mahayana influence are the proto-Mahayana sutras, such as the Ajitasena Sutra. These sutras contain a mixture of Mahayana and pre-Mahayana ideas and occur in a world where monasticism was the norm, which is typical of the Pali Sutras and Agama Sutras generally, And there's none of the antagonism towards the Shravakas or the notion of arahatship, which is typical of many later Mahayana sutras, such as the Lotus Sutra or the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. However, the sutra also has an arahant seeing all the Buddha fields. It is said that reciting the name of the sutra will save beings from suffering and the hell realms, and a meditative practice is described which allows the practitioner to see with the eyes of the Buddha and to receive teachings from the Buddhas in ways that are very much typical of Mahayana sutras. And so especially to notice this last section, meditative practice, which allows the practitioner to see with the eyes of the Buddha and to receive teachings from the Buddhas. Okay? And I think in those kind of passages which you find in the Mahayana sutras, we're seeing a very, very substantial hint as to what the actual origins of the Mahayana sutras were. Right? In other words, that meditators would see visions or hear teachings in the meditation. The Buddha would come to them and give them teachings, and they'd remember that and then repeat them afterwards. And this was that meditative inspiration was, I think, a major source of composition of Mahayana sutras. They interpret it as there's only one Buddha in one world system, whereas in the different world systems and there's countless different Buddhas, and that's a very good point. And also that the notion of the Buddha is becoming much more abstract and metaphorical. It's not just, you know, it's not necessarily a historical understanding in the same way. The earliest Mahayana sutras proper were the very first versions of the Perfection of Wisdom series and texts concerning Akshobhya Buddha, which were probably composed in the 1st century BCE in the south of India. That attribution to the south of India is very, very tenuous. Some slightly later early Mahayana sutras are the Chinese translations made by the Kushan monk Lokakshema. He translated the Ashtasahasrika, Prajnaparamita, Akshobhya Tathagata Swayuha, the Shuranga Samadhi Sutra, an early version of the sutra connected to the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Dhruma Kinnara Raja Paripricha, Bhadrapala Sutra, Ajatasatrukau Kritya Vinodana. So this is really the reason why the Pali tradition is just so much better. But this one is actually, from we've been studying the Samanyapala Sutra, this is actually the dispelling of the Ajatasattu's remorse. Okay? So obviously a retelling of the Samanyapala Sutra story. Kashyapa Parivarta, which probably composed in the north of India in the 1st century CE. Thus scholars generally think the earliest Mahayana Sutras were mainly composed in the south of India, and later the activity of writing additional scriptures was continued in the north. Yeah, maybe. Take that with a pinch of salt. However, the assumption that the presence of an evolving body of Mahayana scriptures implies the contemporaneous existence of Mahayana as a distinct religious movement may be a serious misstep. Exactly. Well, the fact that you've got Mahayana texts doesn't tell you that you had an actual Mahayana movement. Yeah? It just means you've got texts, and the relationship between the text to an actual community or whatever is problematic, to say the least. You know, our religious, you know, what if we have a nuclear war, everything's destroyed, and then in the future aliens come down in thousands of years' time, what religion are they going to discover? Well, what they'll probably discover is the titanium-etched complete works of L. Ron Hubbard as preserved in a nuclear-proof bunker in the desert in America. And I'll take this as a representative. It's a food for thought, isn't it? Okay. Earliest inscription related to Mahayana. Earliest stone inscription, meaning a recognizably Mahayana formulation and a mention of the Buddha Amitabha, was found in the Indian continent in Mathura. Interesting. So, just to point back to this thing, I mean, that's why I love scholarly work so much. We've heard all these things saying Mahayana, it was either in the southeast of India that Mahayana originated or in the northwest. Actually, the first inscription comes from Mathura, which is in the middle. Right? It's somewhat to the north. It's the gate to the northwest. Yeah. So
it's
right now.
A middle implies north and south.
Yeah. Dated to 180 CE. So this is really the period of the flourishing of Buddha and Buddhism in Mathura. You know,
wasn't it the time Buddha hated the
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the Mathura. The roads are rough, dusty, there's lots of dogs, the yuccas are vicious, and it's hard to get alms food.
Yeah, indeed. The worst described town.
It's the Mathura Sutta. Yeah. Later became a great centre for Buddhism. Yeah. Okay, so Mathura. I mean, they had the Sarvasti Vardhans there, Mahasanghikas were there, and so on. 180 CE, in the inscription in Brahmi, made in the year 28 of the reign of King Vishka for the Buddha Amitabha, Amitabhasya Buddhasya. I mean, it's even problematic. I mean, what does it mean to mention the word Amitabha in the context of the Buddha in a completely isolated fragment with there's no context, there's no suggestion that there was an Amitabha school, they've got no idea whether the Amitabha sutras were known there. Maybe, I mean, Amitabha just means infinite light. I mean, it could have been just a local epithet of the Buddha that might not have even had anything to do with what we call Pure Land Buddhism today. Yeah? I mean, maybe it did, but maybe it didn't. We don't really know. In any case, that's the earliest inscription. I believe also it's one of the earliest inscriptions in Sanskrit. Okay, so here's an early Buddhist Mahayana triad. From Gandhara, 2nd to 3rd century, a little bit later than that inscription. I'm going to write a Kushan devotee. Let's play this up. Kushan devotee. So he's the kind of the normal looking one. He seems to have grain or something in his hand, doesn't he? Maybe he's symbolizing the offerings or something he's bringing. And, Kushan devotee, Bodhisattva Maitreya. So that's Maitreya. And of course, you can always identify these, or almost always, through iconography, which is connected. So you see, when you have the iconography, then you do have a definite link between the images and the texts, because the texts will often mention aspects of the particular Buddhas and so on, which you can then identify in the sculptures. And of course that was an interplay between them, that the text might feed off the sculptures, or the sculptures might feed off from the text or whatever, but there's certainly a connection between them. Maitreya, the Buddha.
How do you
know it's Maitreya? Ah, look, I'm not 100% sure in that case. There would be an iconographic reason for that. I'm not quite sure what it is. Yeah, see, he's holding a pot or something there, and various things. Maybe a lamp or something, yeah. And his long earrings. And a necklace. Maitreya Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is Kuan Yin, before he had a gender adjustment. And his.
So they're the same?
Kuan Yin Avalokiteshvara, yeah. Kuan Yin is the. Yeah, Chenrezig and Kuan Yin is the same. Kuan Yin is just a translation, Chinese translation of Avalokiteshvara.
Well,
probably around here. This would be an early, this would be an early occurrence of him, yeah. And as Venerable Antonio mentioned, he's found in the Heart Sutra, but not in the earlier Prajnaparamita literature. So, yeah.
When I was in the deck, there's really old
Yeah, well, this period is at least 500 years, half a millennium before Vajrayana appeared. So on the right I have a Buddhist monk. Interesting to compare his clothes with the layperson's clothes, but also remember this is Gandhara. So this is he's got this kind of short toga-like thing, because it's the Greek language. Yeah, but that was interesting. You can see, say, his outer robe, his Uttara Sangha, sort of comes to a little bit above the lower robe. His lower robe comes almost to his ankles. He wears it quite low.
That's not a problem.
What?
That's too long.
So, okay, the epigraphical evidence for Mahayana in the period before the 5th century is very limited in comparison to the multiplicity of Mahayana writings transmitted from Central Asia to China at that time.
Epigraphical.
That's the inscriptions. Yeah? So, again, this is what our sources are. You actually have a vast, complex, sophisticated Mahayana literature available in Chinese and in Tibet, Tibetan is later, but the early literature in Chinese, at a time when for hundreds of years, basically all you have is this inscription and one or two other bits and pieces in India. Yeah? And so this putting together these bits of evidence, of course, is very problematic. And of course the problem is that Chinese had a great historical sense for China, but almost no historical sense for India. Right, so they had basically no conception of actually how Buddhism had arose and changed and so on in India itself. So during the period of late Mahayana Buddhism, so four major kinds of thought developed: Madhyamaka, Yogacara, Buddha nature or Tathagata Garbha, and Buddhist logic as the last and most recent. In India, the two main philosophical schools of the Mahayana were the Madhyamaka and the later Yogacara. Yogacara is often said to be the same as the Tathagata Garbha school, two different aspects of the same school really, and the Buddhist logical school is most closely associated with the Madhyamaka, and sort of stems ultimately from stems from the paradoxical logic that Nagarjuna used, which itself stems from the logic used in the Agama Sutras. And of course the Buddhist logical schools, whether it was a school or not, it's sort of like a philosophical development, but that of course is these days one of the main parts of study within the Tibetan tradition.
So when you say Agama Sutras, you mean the ones that you've been translated into Chinese?
Oh, just the early sutras generally, yeah, whether Pali or Chinese or whatever, yeah. Agama is the best general word for those, because the word Agama is actually used in the sutras itself, whereas Nikayas isn't, and also Agama is less ambiguous. Nikaya is also used as a word for the early schools, so it's a bit... And Agama, I mean, what we call the Nikayas are actually called Agamas in the commentary, quite commonly. The Pali commentary calls them Agamas.
What's the word Agama mean?
It literally means what has come down, from Agacchati. So it's used in the suttas. Use it as a word for a scripture or a traditional text. Yeah. In Bahasa Indonesia and Malaysia, it means religion. So in the period of late Mahayana Buddhism, four major types of thought. Okay, in India, major schools Madhyamaka and later Yogacara. Though Harvey claims that there were no great Indian teachers associated with Buddha nature thought, or Tathagata Garbha thought, others such as Williams point out to the centrality of the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, Uttara Tantra, to the Buddha nature tradition. Which states one of the features of Tibetan Buddhism in contrast with that of East Asia is a strong tendency to approach the suttas indirectly through the medium of exegetical treatises, if at all. The Ratnagotra Vibhaga has played a relatively small role in East Asian Buddhism, where the primacy has always been given to sutra study. So, saying the difference between Tibetan and Chinese Buddhism is that the Tibetans relied more on commentaries, the Chinese more on the sutras, by which of course it means the Mahayana sutras. From the 5th century CE onwards, Mahayana was a strong movement in India, possibly owing to support by the Gupta dynasty. It spread from India to Southeast Asia and towards the north to Central Asia and the Far East. And of course, in Borobudur and many other places in Southeast Asia has a strong Mahayana influence. And most of the areas, apart from Sri Lanka, most of the areas of Burma, Thailand and so on, were before they were dominated by the Sri Lankan Mahavihara school as they are today, were either Mahayanist or belonged or were influenced by the other early schools. Influence of Mahayana in China seems to have been reached at an earlier time than in India, where Mahayana remained an obscure group until the 5th century. Late stage Mahayana Buddhism in India is found largely in the Vajrayana schools. These were replaced in India and Central Asia after the early millennium by Islam and Hinduism, and in Southeast Asia by Theravada Buddhism from Sri Lanka and Islam. They continue to exist in certain regions of the Himalayas. The earlier stage forms of Mahayana, such as Pure Land Buddhism, are still popular in East Asia. That's a little bit misleading. There's no suggestion from India that there ever existed a school of Pure Land Buddhism in India. The Pure Land text existed, but there's no evidence that there was a school based on those texts, and the school itself was formed in China, where many new religious movements and syncretisms have also been formed with Mahayana elements. And that, of course, continues to the present day with movements like the Falun Gong and so on. Doctrine. Few things can be said with certainty about Mahayana Buddhism, especially its early Indian form, other than that the Buddhism practiced in China, Vietnam, Korea, Tibet, and Japan is Mahayana Buddhism. Okay, excellent. So from here on in, we've left the blacks and the whites, and we're in those shades of grey. Mahayana can be described as a loosely bound bundle of many teachings. This looseness has enabled it to contain the various contrasting ideas in those differing teachings. Okay, and one of the it's an interesting thing with religious traditions. The whole thing about a religious tradition is that you look back to the past, right, and you say, well, this is our teacher, or this is our scripture, or this is our text, and you revere that, right? So there's an attitude of reverence towards the sacred scripture as a sort of source of truth. And yet, of course, then there's always new ideas coming up, new contexts, new ways of looking at things, and so the texts get interpreted. But then later generations have to revere both the interpretation and the original text, and so then you've got that, and then it comes an ongoing process. And so the whole nature of hermeneutics and the interpretation of texts and the way that you look at them and the way that you see these things together sort of continually develops and evolves in sort of higher and higher levels of organization and structure to be able to try to make sense of these different things. And that influences notions, for example, it influences notions like, say, what is the truth? Because if you have, you may well have, say, two early texts which were written by people who were quite opposed to each other and actually going out and out to try and criticize each other. Later on, you accept both of them as canonical and as expressions of the truth, right? But then you have to try to explain that away. And so you then have to develop a new theory of truth to be able to explain how both of them can be true in different ways. Yeah? So these things, the fact that there's a complexity and a diversity within a tradition is one of the main forces that generates a sophisticated philosophical response to that diversity.
Would that be how that when the last video came, you said that the Buddha neither dwells in samsara nor in nirvana, but in somewhere in between those two things? Would that be like something that would have come up later by making another state,
exactly,
between nirvana and between samsara, sort of.
Yeah, well, except I don't know if it would be a state, but yes, that's right. Yeah, because it would be, you know, nirvana and samsara would be perceived as being another dualism. That's one of Nagarjuna's critiques of early Buddhist. Yeah, so according to Sarvastivada or Theravada, nirvana exists, right? So it's one of the very, very few things that Theravada actually says about Nibbana is that it exists. Mm. Right? And so that wasn't good enough for Nagarjuna, right? So you have to sort of try it. But then the way we'll look at Nagarjuna more later, but the way he puts things is very subtle, right? So the way Nagarjuna says, he says something like, have a look at it more later, but he says something like, if I remember it correctly, it's something like, the first point of samsara would be the first point of nirvana.
So, meaning that they coexist?
No, meaning, listen to what he's saying. The first point of samsara would be the first point of nirvana. Of course, there is no first point of samsara. Yeah?
So there can't be a point of nirvana.
He's not necessarily making that conclusion, but that's the kind of... It's a very subtle point, isn't it? Yeah?
That's too subtle for me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Nagarjuna is kind of like that.
I wonder why then you have all these different schools of Mahayana and they contradict each other, but they all live very nicely in harmony. why they reject the Theravadin or whatever is not.
Yeah, well, you know, you're kind of united by a common enemy, I guess.
what makes them an enemy? Like this?
Yeah, yeah. What
makes the split?
Like, what made the tension, yeah?
Yeah. Why would it be that rather than all the other 10 different differences within the Maya? Because then, purely.
Well, just to come back to that, but there were a lot of tensions and arguments within Mahayana as well.
Yeah, but
we all still think of ourselves as Buddhists. So, I mean, there's a greater kind of meta category, but they still argued with each other. But look, it is a good point. Like, why was it the case? Because you do find this quite shrill and polemical tone within, not all, but within a substantial number of the Mahayana sutras. So obviously there's a bit of heat there. So why was that? That's a very good question. Yeah.
There was actually kind of book on this thing about why Mahayanists reject the points of rejection. Even in Mahayana schools, we are always encouraged to learn Theravadins before you can even embark on Mahayanists. I mean, of course, again, they are trying to sort of like think that Mahayanists is better, but in the Chinese tradition, we don't even have a basic foundation of Buddhism, like what we call Shravakayana, then it's impossible to even learn about. So there's no rejection actually. It's just that they feel that Bodhisattvayana is much better way to. But I also refer to rejection. I was referring like where do you make the split and why? Like I was just thinking because I was reading one of the articles and I was thinking, Judaism and Christianity. So there's a lot of sects in Judaism, but they become enemies to one another because Christianity has an interest in becoming the Roman Catholic, the Roman Empire religions in this way. Really made an effort to distinguish themselves, even though they were basically Jews to begin with. And then I'm looking for what is it in the early split that would make it essential for one group to say we're not them.
Because of the lack of real concrete and serious evidence. Difficult to say, but it could well have been similar kinds of things. For example, competing for patronage.
Because I read it in history. Well, another book about history of Buddhism, and it had a lot about history of Mahayana in China. And from the very early times, that is exactly what happened. I mean, the ruling classes were very interested in Buddhism for very pragmatic reasons. Because it could help them solve some of their problems. I mean, it all seemed to be quite complex. And then they seemed to be, some of the dynasties supported Buddhism really strongly, and then the next sort of ruler might reject it. It's a very, very long and complex history of Mahayana in China, and all these different schools arose because of some of those, well, it seemed to me from when my reading of it, the political and social environment in which it developed in China was really influential.
What comes to my mind is that it's probably like the species evolved. Your single species means because the two populations, geographically divided, they evolve as single species.
Except they weren't geographically divided at the time.
Mahayana was born in India.
Not sort of by language, but by culture.
Not really.
Mahayana was born in India.
Yeah.
He's in India and they're often in the same monasteries.
But I mean, in terms of what we have today.
In terms of what we have today, in terms of later development, sure. Yeah. But in terms of the origins of Mahayana, I'm not so sure.
The origins is from 500 CE when it was in India. It became influential.
Well, no, the origins is
first
century CE.
But there's no evidence or anything.
No, there's all the Chinese translations of
Yes, the only evidence is Chinese, not Indian. So yeah. We don't know anything about its development in India. I mean, how do
we know a lot about its development in India because of the Indian texts that were translated into Chinese. But what we don't know is that a lot about the specific location and timing of events in India. Okay, so we know quite a lot about the doctrines and things. So some things we know a lot about, other things we know very little about.
So you said the reason that we know the Chinese text, the reason that we know that they were translated from Indian texts is because the texts that are in Sanskrit are still also available.
That's why. I mean, we know that because the Chinese texts say so. They have a remark at the beginning of them saying this text was translated in year so-and-so by the month so-and-so and so-and-so. Actually, they're usually translated by a small team of translators. There'd be usually one who was the Indian language specialist and one who'd be the Chinese language specialist. Maybe one or two others who are helping with the scribes. Some of them were translated from text. Others were translated from memory. So we know that already, and then that's been confirmed by the existing Sanskrit texts, mainly from Central Asia and Nepal, and also by the Tibetan translation.
Do they say, when they do the Tibetan translation, they didn't actually leave a record of the, what's the metadata about the text?
They did give metadata to the text, and it did say here's the translator, here's the time and the place and so on, but they didn't give everything. They just gave certain details might be there, but other details not. Yeah.
Okay, I can't remember the book that we were referred to when I was writing Buddhism. It seems that it could be Eki Water's book or something like that. It seems that during the time in India there was this period, I can't quite remember the period, where a lot of monks were not practicing very well, and those who were practicing became arahants. So, and during that time they also had these influences of foreign religions into India. So they had this Christianity and Islam and other religions where they had this god concept. So the Buddhist laity, the Buddhist community were actually questioning the monastics of Buddhism that if each of you who are really practicing wants to become an arahant, then who is there to come back to teach us, to lead us? And it seems that because of all these Western foreign religious influences, and because of this question by the people that if everybody becomes an arahant, then who will remain in the world to come and teach those other people to lead the life of the Buddha's footsteps? So it seems that from here an idea actually emerged that there should be something like the Bodhisattva concept, where this practitioners make vows to come back life after life so that they can teach the people, to lead the people towards the other shore.
Yeah.
I think that was how it was introduced to us when we were learning about
the origin of
Mahayanism in India.
Yeah. No, I don't agree with that theory. Islam didn't appear in India till 1,000 years after the period we're talking. Mm-hmm. Christianity never was influential in India, although obviously Islam was at a later period, but that was, there wasn't much interaction between Islam and Buddhism because they destroyed the Buddhists. In Central Asia, there was an interaction between certain forms of Christianity and Buddhism, and that did probably contribute to the emergence and the development of some kind of ideas. And Etienne Lamotte talks about that very interestingly at the end of his book on Indian Buddhism. So there was an influence between, say, the development of the idea of Maitreya and Jesus and various kinds of things, and there's a lot of archaeological evidence for that. But again, this is quite considerably later than the early formation period that we're talking here. There was no substantial influence of foreign religions in the actual origins of Mahayana. Okay, there may have been in certain later developments, but not in the actual origins. The origins, really come from the, I would root much more in the sort of the old Indian tradition, the rebirth tradition, you know, and this is one of the great, great sources of sort of development of Mahayana. Okay. So, and just to come back to the point you made earlier, and as you said quite rightly, that typically in the modern Chinese and certainly also the modern Tibetan educational spheres, there's a very strong emphasis that you have to be very well grounded on the early Buddhist teachings before learning the Mahayana, and that obviously manifests in most all of the great Indian Mahayanist scholars as well. Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu and so on were very well grounded in the Agama Sutras. But there's also there's also a tension there, because you also find within Mahayana Sutras that there's this criticism. So again, this is just like the diversity of it, that they, you know, sometimes may be critical, other times bringing it in, and so on. So there's this strong complexity in the situation. This is why they're saying that there's few things can be said with certainty, because every time you look at one thing, you can always find a counterexample. Which is, again, it's not a problem in a sense, it's just a very natural, it's almost like Mahayana, you almost get the idea that with one of the, this is very subjective, but one of the feelings that I get is that with early Buddhism and like Theravada, you had almost like a sort of a narrowing and a tendency to control and to say, well, these doctrines are right and those doctrines are wrong. And that was one of the points of tension that the Mahayana broke out of. And that this was connected very strongly. I have a feeling that the origin of Mahayana really had a strong connection with the development of writing in India. And that for the first time, a yogi could sit there in meditation and they maybe go along and listen to this kind of Abhidhamma teacher telling them this is this and this and that and that and that and that. And, that. And they get sort of constricted into this kind of grid of doctrine. And they go away and they meditate, and then you realize this kind of boundless love and light and all of these amazing things. And then you can come out of meditation and actually write about it for the first time. Yeah? And so there's this like personal creativity and inspiration is this kind of upswelling. And so this, I think, is where a lot of the diversity comes from, because it wasn't with oral literature. Because with an oral literature, you have to organize large groups of people, get them together and say, you know, we're going to get, you know, 50 monks here and 50 there and 100 there to memorize these texts and keep on teaching each other. But with written literature, you just write it and stick it in a library. Yeah?
So it's like the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. It's absolutely a step in that direction. Yeah. And that actually influences, I think the origin of writing also influences the philosophy in very profound and very interesting ways. So in early Buddhism, there's the idea that the present moment exists and the past and the future don't exist. Right? Yeah? That's the Theravadan point of view. The present moment exists, the past and the future don't exist. But that's what a text exists if you're reciting it, doesn't it? If you're reciting Evan Me Sutan, only that syllable that you recite exists, and everything else is either in the past and the future, they don't exist. Whereas if you have a book, the whole book exists, right? You open a book at a particular page, you read one word, but you can't deny that the rest of the book exists. Yeah? So this later tendency, Sarvastivadin tendency in philosophy, I think, you know, because they say that all the dharmas in past, present and future exist, and so that means the phenomena of existence exist, but I think it also means the teachings exist. And then this Mahayana teachings you have, it takes it to the next step where everything exists all the time, and you have this Indra's net idea, this kind of omnipresent interlinking of everything all at the same time. Again, that's what a text does. Everything is present and is connected in that thing all the time. So that is
nothing exists.
Well, exactly. Exactly. But that's also nothing, isn't it? Because that's also not the real Dhamma.
So yeah, all those things. Yeah, really is nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's also emptiness also fits in there as well. All the dhammas exist, and yet they don't, because that's actually not real dhamma. Yeah.
You're also one very clear point of vision with Theravada Mahayana. With Theravada, any kind of desire is bad. You don't want to hang around some desire. You need a story, uncompromising.
Yeah.
Mahayana actually suggests we hang around the bottom.
Well, not necessarily. Yeah, I mean, there is that difference, and certainly a difference of emphasis, but there's a lot of people who within what they call Theravada who practice Bodhisattva path.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah, maybe also it seems suspicious to actually argue with it, so we want to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But what does it mean to practice the Bodhisattva path?
I mean, well, it says, I want to get reborn so that I can become a Buddha in the future and help all sentient beings. As opposed to saying, I want to get enlightened right now. Okay. Okay, so most of these ideas that we've looked at, the Srimala Sutra claims that the Buddha said the devotion to Mahayana is inherently superior in its virtues to the following of the Shravaka or Pratyeka Buddha path. Mahayana schools de-emphasize the idea of the release from suffering and attainment of nirvana. The fundamental principles of Mahayana are based on the possibility of universal liberation from suffering for all beings and the existence of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas embodying Buddha nature. Actually, all beings embody Buddha nature. Some Mahayana schools simplify the expression of faith by allowing salvation to be alternatively obtained through the grace of the Buddha Amitabha by having faith and devoting oneself to chanting Amitabha. This devotional stand, of course, is the Pure Land School, most prominent in East Asia. Spiritual elements such as reciting of the Buddha's name, mantras and dharanis, reading of Mahayana sutras and mysticism. Chinese Buddhism, blah, blah. Okay, so most Mahayana schools believe in a pantheon of quasi-divine bodhisattvas that devote themselves to personal excellence, ultimate knowledge and the salvation of humanity and all other sentient beings. So the development of the pantheon of bodhisattvas and Buddhas is very comparable, I think, to the development of the pantheon of the saints in Catholicism. In Mahayana, the Buddha is seen as the ultimate highest being present at all times in all beings in all places, and the bodhisattvas came to represent the universal ideal of altruistic excellence. The other thing about bodhisattvas, as is common with sort of the saints in Catholicism, is that the tendency in religions is always to, you take your highest, whether it be the Buddha or God or whatever, and you make him higher and higher and higher and higher, which is all very nice, except he kind of disappears from view. And you're like, yeah, the Buddha is so magnificent and so wonderful and so up there and so irrelevant to my life. And so this is why bodhisattvas are a little bit more human, right? And so they can be a bit more quirky, they can be a bit more fun, and they can be a bit more specific. Yeah, so you have like a medicine Buddha or something like that, and the different Buddhas and bodhisattvas who relate to actually specific aspects of day-to-day life, whereas the Buddha himself has become so abstract. And exactly the same thing happens in Christianity and theistic religions, that God becomes so far up there you have to introduce Jesus to mediate between God and us, and then later on Jesus drifts up into the sky again, so you have to keep introducing the saints as well to make the connection. Okay, so Zen, of course, focusing on meditation. Zen, of course, being just the Japanese pronunciation of jhana. Okay, Mahayana Buddhism can in general be characterized by one, universalism. Everyone will become a Buddha. Bodhicitta as the main focus of realization. Okay, so bodhicitta is, of course, the arising in the mind of the aspiration to realize Buddhahood for the sake of liberation of all sentient beings and to remain in samsara until all sentient beings are liberated. Compassion through the transfer of merit, or the transfer of merit, is another one of these doctrines which scholars often associate with Mahayana, but which is absolutely universal in Theravada Buddhism. So there's no ground at all for saying that transfer of merit is Mahayana. Transcendental immanence, in that the immortal Buddha principle is present within all beings. And so this is the Tathagata Garbha thought, the Buddha nature thought. Philosophical Mahayana tends to focus on the first three of these characteristics and in some schools of Buddha nature without showing much interest in supernatural constructions, while devotional Mahayana focuses mainly on salvation towards other worldly realms.
Yeah,
I think it's always expressed in these paradoxical phrases, you know, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. You know? And so, of course, how you interpret that is then a matter for the individuals, whether it's meant to be taken literally, or whether it's meant as an aspiration or something like that. Yeah. So you see, one of the things with Mahayana always to remember is that on the one hand you have this this incredible proliferation of things, of Buddha lands and all of these things and different things. And on the other hand, you also have this emphasis that everything actually is just a product of your mind. Yeah? And so there's always the two ways of looking at things. And of course in the simpler or simplistic forms of it tend to literalize it. So you know, sort of folk Buddhism, you think, well, Amitabha is a Buddha who lives in a place which is far away to the west, you know? Whereas actually from a philosophical point of view, you know, then it's more like a meditative thing or a reflection or something like that. So all of these, that's again one of the dynamics that you find all the time within the Mahayana. So it's one hand, and so even this idea I mentioned before about the Buddhas who come to you in meditation and they're teaching to you, yeah? And so you say, well, that's just your imagination, yeah? And so you can say, well, the whole world's just your imagination, yeah? And you can say, well, how can you know that that's what the Buddha said? And the Mahayanists would, with good reason, say, well, you know, to a Hinayanist, right? Say, well, why shouldn't I trust the vision that I received in my meditation? You place your trust in a text which has been handed down. Well, who's to say that this text represents what the Buddha said any more than what I've seen in my meditation? I know, because my meditation was so powerful and convincing to me, that there's truth in it. Yeah?
I don't know.
Oh, but that's what they actually say quite explicitly.
Yeah, but this is not how we have been taught.
Yeah, but that's again we're focusing on like you know origins of Mahayana, not on how Mahayana. This is 2,000 years ago. So what you've been taught in Mahayana schools in Taiwan today is not necessarily the same as the origins of it. Yeah. So this is why we're trying to again look back at what the origins of it. Those things are said very explicitly in the Mahayana sutras. Okay, so that's not an inference, that's almost a direct translation from what I would be delighted to refer to as the Pratyutpana Buddhavasthita Samadhi Sutra, and that's exactly what it says, almost word for word. Yeah, so here the Bodhisattva sits in meditation and the Buddhas come and teach to him and then they reveal the Dhammas that haven't been heard before, and then the meditator remembers those teachings and then he passes them on and so on. And you also have this phenomenon where you know, a lot of some of the great Mahayana scholars, like Asanga and others, said that their teacher was Maitreya. So in what sense does that mean their teacher was Maitreya? But I would say it probably means the same thing. It means that's like a source of their devotion and the insights that they got in their meditation.
So I was actually thinking that for a person to be meditating to a certain extent, they will have some psychic power and where they are able to actually interact with beings of all realms.
Mm-hmm.
It could be possible.
Yeah.
But the Buddha actually, I mean, according to the Mahayana's teaching, the Buddha actually could go up to Tathagata Sahara to teach his mother.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was during his meditative state of
yeah,
mind.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that all these things are meditative states of mind,
yeah,
where you have that psychic power to interact with different realms.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, again, it could well be. But you find exactly that process, quite explicitly, is taught in the biography of Ajahn Mun. I mean, that's what it says. It says that he went and saw the Buddha and things like that, and the Buddha gave him various teachings, and he comes back and he teaches it.
Really?
Yeah. There's Arahats, but there's also the Buddha as well. There's at least one passage in Ataman's biography where he talks about that. And then there's various things like, you know, and then Adamahabua says this these kinds of things quite explicitly. He said that the Anathalakana Sutta, the discourse on not self, can't be correct because it doesn't talk about the deathless mind that's beyond the five khandhas. And so it must be wrong because, you know, I know that that's what the real thing is, the real deal is. So that even today in so-called Theravada, you know, some monks are quite happy to criticize things that are found in the suttas based on their own meditative experiences and visions and so on. Yeah. Okay. Mahayana traditions generally consider that attainment of the level of an arahant is not final. This is based on a subtle doctrinal distinction between the Mahayana and some of the early Buddhist schools concerning the issues of nirvana with remainder, okay, and nirvana without remainder. This is upadhisesa nibbana and anupadhisesa nibbana. This is a distinction that's introduced in one or two suttas in the Agama suttas, and essentially what it means is nirvana with remainder is the life of the arahant during this lifetime. That's how it's interpreted in Theravada anyway. And nirvana without remainder is after the passing away of the Buddha or an arahant. The Mahayana position here is similar to that of the early schools of the Mahasanghika. Some of the early schools considered that the nirvana without remainder always follows nirvana with remainder. Buddhas or arahants first achieve enlightenment and then at death, mahaparinirvana, and that nirvana without remainder is final. Whereas Mahayana traditions consider that nirvana without remainder is always followed by nirvana with remainder. The state of attainment of that Hinayana arahant is not final and is eventually succeeded by the total awakening of Buddhahood. This distinction is most evident regarding doctrinal concerns about the capability of a Buddha after nirvana, which is identified by the early schools as being nirvana without remainder. Most importantly, amongst the early schools, a complete Buddha, Samyak Sambuddha, Sama Sambuddha in Pali, is not able to directly point the way to nirvana after death. This is a major distinction between the early schools and some schools of Mahayana, who conversely state that once a totally enlightened Buddha arises, he or she continues to directly and actively point the way to nirvana until there are no beings left in samsara. This difference between the two views of early schools and Mahayana is exactly why some Mahayana schools do not talk about a bodhisattva postponing nirvana, and exactly why the early schools do. In other words, the Buddha keeps on enlightening beings even after he's passed away. No, it's mainly talking about a distinction between early schools and Mahayana. So the argument here is it's saying that the early schools say that once a Buddha's gone, he's gone, and that the Mahayana argue that once he's gone, he's still there somehow.
Some souls in Mahayana who have one view and some others that might read that.
And the idea of postponing arahantship is like so many of these doctrines, descended from the Jatakas, where, again, according to the developed Jataka doctrine, even at the very first birth, when the Bodhisattva makes his actual first determination to become the Buddha, he already in that lifetime has to be capable of attaining arahantship within that life. Okay? But he decides he's going to postpone it until he becomes a Buddha in the future.
So the idea that there's only one Buddha at a time,
and that Buddhas arrive only after a period of like spiritual darkness. That's not really a Mahayana idea very much then.
Well, I would. I mean, the next bit goes on to talk about that. Maybe we'll have a look at the next bit and see that. I think there's, often you find there's still the same general background idea is there, but it gets just more complicated. However, some Mahayana schools do talk of a bodhisattva deliberately refraining from Buddhahood. For example, the early schools held that Maitreya will not attain nirvana while Gautama Buddha's teachings still exist. In contrast, some Mahayana schools hold that Maitreya will be the next Buddha manifest in the world and will introduce the Dharma when it no longer exists. He is not postponing his nirvana to do so, and when he dies or enters Mahaparinirvana, he will likely continue to teach Dharma for all time. Moreover, some Mahayana schools argue that although it's true, for this world system, Maitreya will be the next Buddha to manifest, there are an infinite number of world systems, many of which have currently active Buddhas, or Buddhas-to-be, manifesting. Because Mahayana traditions assert that everyone will eventually achieve totally and total enlightenment, the Mahayana is labelled universalist, whereas the task of the early scriptures is obtaining nirvana depends on effort and is not predetermined. Alright? Okay, so the Bodhisattva ideal, later Mahayana school, holds that pursuing only the release from suffering, attainment of nirvana, is too narrow. Primary focus of some Mahayana schools is bodhicitta, to strive for the awakened mind of Buddhahood for the benefit of oneself and others. Ananda Kumara Swami notes the most essential part of the Mahayana is its emphasis on the Bodhisattva ideal, which replaces the arahat or ranks before it. According to Mahayana teachings, being a high-level Bodhisattva involves possessing a mind of great compassion, conjoined with insight, realizing the reality of emptiness and or the Buddha nature of all beings. Mahayana teaches that the practitioner will realize Buddhahood, the final goal of full awakening, an omniscient, blissful mind, completely free of suffering and its causes, with which one is able to work tirelessly for the benefit of all living beings. And just to notice that the word bodhisattva is also used in complex ways within Mahayana itself, and it's used, I mean, two very common ways. Is one, it's used as the name of very highly regarded beings who are regarded as essentially enlightened or virtually enlightened already, like Avalokiteshvara and so on, but it's also used in the sense of, well, everyone should be a bodhisattva, so all kind of Mahayana followers are bodhisattva in a kind of a lesser sense. And the Mahayana texts themselves discuss these differences. Mahayana teachers, and so on, six virtues or paramita are listed for the bodhisattva: generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. That's dana, sila, kanti, virya, samadhi, and panya. Many philosophical schools of Mahayana sutras have focused on the nature of enlightenment and nirvana itself, from the Madhyamaka and Yogacara and so on. So just to come back to these six paramita, this is another idea which is shared in common with the Theravada, of course, has 10 paramitas. And interestingly enough, that in this case, the six paramitas of the usually found within the northern schools, of course there are always variations, but typically these ones are found. And this is closer in its formulation to the early Buddhist teachings, you know, dana, sila, kanti, energy, samadhi, and wisdom. And I'm not aware that we find exactly that list of dhammas in the Pali Canon, but it's certainly extremely similar to very many of the teachings you find in the Pali Canon. Whereas the 10 paramis of the Theravada system are actually you can still recognize, for example, the framework of Sila Samadhi Panya is still apparent in this framework. It's just slightly elaborated. Whereas in the 10 paramis of the Theravada tradition, it's almost completely lost that kind of connection. So it's even perhaps further away from early Buddhist teachings. So, compassion. Bodhisattvas, Mahayana liberation, anything? So nothing there we haven't discussed already, but Avalokiteshvara is considered to be the main embodiment of compassion. And of course the thousand arms and so on, the different ways that he's helping sentient beings. And compassion has a very active sense in that way in Mahayana. Not just a feeling of compassion, but an active doing of them. And the word Avalokiteshvara can be explained in a number of ways. Ava means down. Lokita can be explained either as looking, so looking down, and Ishvara is the Lord, so it's like the Lord who looks down, or who looks down with compassion on the world. But also Svara can be understood as hearing, and Loka can be understood as the world. So it's translated as the one who hears the cries of the world. Okay, and that being the...
Christ's not there, it's just here.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I'm not sure. It might be in the way that it's explained. I'm not 100% sure of the details, but that, of course, being what the Chinese Guan Yin is translated from. Guan Quan Shi Yin. Okay, so skillful means upaya. Skillful means upaya is found in the Lotus Sutra, the earliest stated Mahayana Sutra, and is accepted in all Mahayana schools of thought. It's any effective method which aids to the attainment of awakening. And of course, this idea harks back to the skillful means which you see constantly through the Agama Sutras and the different ways that the Buddha taught people, but particularly was emphasized by Upagupta in Mathura. And he was a real master in the legends anyway of using all kinds of very eccentric ways of bringing people to awakening. Oh, God. So many different ones that he used. I'm just trying to think of specific examples now. Yeah, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but maybe have to have a look at the texts. Oh, some specific examples of the kinds of skillful means that Upagupta uses. Yeah. There's well, he's supposed to be around the time of Ashoka, but the texts which are telling of his stories are from the Mataran period, probably not too different from the Mataran inscription that we found above there. So I think it's probably that particular aspect, I would say, is probably derived from Upagupta. Okay, so upaya is basically any effective method that leads to awakening. So it could be just a particular skillful way of using a particular teaching. So, you know, teaching according to the characteristic of a person or addressing their particular problem in a very skillful way. But it tends to anything, but specifically, it usually refers to using some kind of means which is in some ways kind of unexpected or and so it comes used in that way. Yeah, exactly. So that was Upagupta teaching or being taught? I can't remember.
He was being taught.
So that's where he was being taught to count the put a count of black stone for every bad thought and a white stone for every white thought. Yeah, and so every day, because he was a merchant, right? So he used to sort of tallying everything up. So he was told, every time you have a bad thought, you put a black feet, and then at the end of the day, you can count up how many black stones you have and how many white stones. And so every day he did that, and every day the black stones went down a little bit and the white stones went up a little bit. So that's a very nice example of a skillful means. And so one of the purposes or the ways that this then develops is that, of course, then this becomes an explanatory tool, whereas in the early Buddhist schools, they would tend to say, why, when there's different texts and different teachings, why are they presented differently? And the usual explanation is that it's presented differently according to the different character of the people being taught, okay? And the upaya thing is really a development from that. And so you can say, well, even why are contradictory doctrines being taught? Well, because that's the level of their understanding at that time. So this is another way that these different things can be harmonized. So the Pali term upaya kosala does occur in the Pali canon in the Sangiti Sutra of the Digha Nikaya, which is a proto-Abhidhamma sutra. Devotional Mahayana developed a rich cosmography with various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas residing in paradise realms. The concept of the three bodies, Parikaya, supports these constructions, making the Buddha himself a transcendental figure. Dr. Quang Xing describes the Mahayana Buddha as an omnipotent divinity endowed with numerous supernatural attributes and qualities. He is described almost as an omnipotent and almighty Godhead. So there's definitely this tendency to move the Mahayana, to deify the Mahayana, Mahayana Buddha, although one thing where I believe is quite different. I mean, I think omnipotent is probably getting a bit far. I don't know if the Buddhas, Mahayana Buddhas, are certainly would be regarded as omniscient, as all-knowing. but it says almost omnipotent, but I don't know if they're really regarded as being omnipotent in the sense that they can just decree anything and make anything happen that they wanted to. If they could, then why wouldn't they just take all the suffering away from beings? But another difference between Mahayana Buddhas and God is that they're usually not conceived of as being a creator. Okay, so they're not the creator of the world in the same sense. So,
yeah. When I spoke on Sean, they just have thousands and thousands. Is that, any explanation for that?
You find that all through the Mahayana Sutras, it talks about the countless Buddhas and the countless Buddha realms and so on and so forth.
It's just repetitions of the same one. There's lots of different ones.
Well, it's lots of different ones, but it becomes a bit difficult to differentiate them all. I mean, in practice, you have a few major ones who are the most practically important, but then there's references to thousands and so on of others. But again, as you know, just to remember that almost every Mahayana Sutra says something different, and we'll have a different group of Buddhas and so on, different relationship with them. Okay, so under various conditions, the realms over which a Buddha presides could be attained by devotees after their death, so that when reborn, they could strive towards Buddhahood in the best possible conditions. This is the Pure Land idea. Depending on the sect, this salvation to quote-unquote paradise, remember that paradise originally just meant the garden, can be obtained by faith, imaging, or sometimes even by the simple invocation of the Buddha's name. This approach to salvation is the origin of the mass appeal of devotional Buddhism, especially represented by Pure Land. This rich cosmography also allowed Mahayana... It's debatable, incidentally, whether this idea that just by invoking, by chanting the Buddha's name, that you could get reborn in the Pure Land, it's debatable whether that is actually found in the Pure Land Sutras themselves, or whether it's actually an artifact of the translation of those sutras into Chinese, because the Pali was, the Chinese is Nianfo, which is probably means the Buddha Anusati, is the recollection of the Buddha, so it's a meditation, but came to be interpreted as meaning the recitation of the Buddha's name.
It seems that it has to come with faith and aspirations before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just mechanically doing it, yeah.
According to the sutra, without faith and without fire, you must have a very strong determination to aspire to be born there. With that faith and aspiration,
yeah.
Okay, does the Pure Land also refer to like those sutras that talks about being born in the Medicine Buddha's paradise too? Or is it purely Amitabha?
Pure Land?
Yeah. Pure Land itself, does it refer to just Amitabha?
Well, you'd know that, because the Pure Land is a Chinese concept. Mm-hmm. So you'd know that, I mean, the Pure Land School is a Chinese concept. The Pure Land itself is an Indian concept. But the Pure Land School is a Chinese concept, so you'd know that better than I would. Mm-hmm. How do they use it? How do they use that in Chinese Buddhism usually?
Every time we talk about Pure Land, right now,
yeah.
Pure Land equals to
Amitabha's realm.
When they talk about this Pure Land, this thing to Zong means that's Pure Land. But
okay.
I don't know whether they also include other paradise, like
Medicine
Paradise,
Medicine
Buddha.
Yeah, because in the sutras, there are, as you say, there are many different representations of similar kinds of ideas. Yeah. Now, for some reason, which is just a historical reason, the Amitabha Sutras became the very central ones for Chinese Pure Land, but it seems that wasn't the case in India, that there were a variety of these different things which may have been localized or something like that. So it would depend on the context that you're talking about. Yeah.
According to what we have been taught, it seems that this Amitabha Sutra is the only sutra that the Buddha preaches without being asked by others to teach. He actually taught it without being asked. Other sutras were normally, taught when questions were asked, but it was only this sutra that stopped being asked and he taught it. It still comes under the Das Ahaya Purit
Sutra. So this rich cosmography allowed Mahayana to be quite syncretic and accommodating of other faiths or deities. Various origins have been suggested to explain its emergence, such as popular Hindu devotional cults and Persian and Greco-Roman theologies which filtered into India from the northwest. So again, this is kind of speculative. I mean, certainly there was a connection, there was a parallel movement of the emergence of a devotional tendency within Mahayana Buddhism and early Buddhism as well, but Buddhism generally, but mostly in Mahayana, but and a parallel tendency to develop a devotional cult in Hinduism at the time. And so no doubt those were related. The influence of Persian and Greco-Roman theologies is possibly, but not such a big influence, really. I mean, yeah, I personally, I find it a little bit, I mean, at that period of time, the Greco-Roman, okay, because it was the Greeks who were there, but the Greek religion was, I mean, Greek intellectuals didn't even really believe in it even then. I mean, Greek society had become fairly cynical and questioning of their own religious tradition and so on by that stage. And I find I don't know whether there has been a huge influence there really. Anyway. The teaching of Buddha nature, Tathagata Garbha. So notice that the actual Sanskrit phrase here. Translators Buddha nature, the Sanskrit phrase Tathagata, of course the standard word used for the Buddha, we find this all through the suttas, and Garbha, meaning embryo. Okay? So it's the embryo of the Buddha. And so the original idea is probably much more that there's like everyone has a seed or potential for awakening within themselves. But came to be interpreted gradually as meaning that everyone's already inherently awakened. So this is a later development in Mahayana. This is where we've moved quite a long way from a discussion of the origins of Mahayana here. Tathagata Garbha thought isn't found explicitly until probably 500 years after Mahayana has arisen. Okay, it may be based on the luminous mind concept found in the Agamas, which is obviously a relationship between them. The essential idea articulated in the Buddha Nature Sutras, but not accepted by all Mahayanists, is that no being is without a concealed but indestructible interior link to the awakening of Bodhi, and that this link is an uncreated element or principle deep inside each being, which constitutes nothing less than the deathless, diamond-like essence of the self. Whew. As it says, not accepted by all Mahayanists here. The Mahaparinirvana Sutra, now this of course is the Mahayanist Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which is a totally different text from the Pali Mahaparinirvana Sutra, and it's important to recognize that the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, as it's found in the Pali, has parallel sutras in Sanskrit, in Tibetan, and in the Chinese Agamas and so on. Now all of that is completely separate as a literature from this text, which is a late Mahayana Sutra. This text states that the essence of the self Atman is the subtle Buddha nature, while the later Lankavatara Sutra states that the Buddha nature might be taken to be the self, but it is not. So Mahaparinirvana Sutra is perhaps of all the Mahayana Sutras the one which most explicitly teaches the doctrine of self. Most Mahayana Sutras don't, and in fact the whole basis of the Prajnaparamita is all about not self, really. I'm very sceptical about the amount of influence that these kinds of ideas had in Indian Mahayana. In the Buddha Nature Class of Sutras, the word self is used in a way defined by and specific to these sutras. According to some scholars, the Buddha Nature Tathagata Garbha discussed in some Mahayana sutras does not represent a substantial self or Atman, rather it is a positive language and expression of emptiness, shunyata, and represents the potentiality to realize Buddhahood through Buddhist practices. It is the true self in representing the innate aspect of the individual which makes actualizing the ultimate personality possible. And so on. We don't need to go too much into it.
When they said it according to some scholars.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So are there the scholars in that way, or they believe that the sutra?
Mm-hmm. It would be the scholars discussing the sutra. But this is an active debate within contemporary Mahayana as well. and in fact is like one of the tensions, like say within Theravada, you know, one of the tensions that we argue about is like samatha and vipassana or something like that. So we have our own particular family arguments. So one of the particular Mahayana family arguments is the argument, is this particular argument, is what is Buddha nature and how is it differentiated from the self. And so for example, in Chinese Buddhism, classical Chinese Buddhism, the Tathagata Gaudapa thought was typically regarded as being the highest expression of Buddhist teachings, whereas Yim Shun more recently came along and said, no, actually the Madhyamaka teaching on emptiness was the highest expression of the Buddha's teachings, and that the Tathagata Gaudapa thought was an upaya. Okay, so Yim Shun regarded the teachings of the Tathagata Gaudapa as a skillful means adopted to teaching people who are used to the non-dual Hindu teachings in ancient India, rather than a literal expression of the highest truth. Okay, so that's an active debate within, certainly within Chinese Buddhism today.
Yeah, but the sutta itself, is that correct for the essence of the self?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So the sutta itself does.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So the, I'm not sure of that exact phrase, but it certainly does speak in those kinds of terms, yeah.
And is it,
is there
influence from Hinduism?
There is a mutual influencing between Hinduism and Buddhism, yeah, definitely. Which, of course, is another sort of whole strata to the complexity, is the complexity within Buddhism itself, and then the relationship between Buddhism and other things.
Isn't that one of the arguments about why Buddhism has been traded out in India even before what was starting to disintegrate in Buddhism?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because of its melding.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Because, like, you think it's a good time to, you know, argue about Atman.
Yeah. It is, but that's also, and I've no doubt there's some truth to that, but it's also one of the interesting things in Indian archaeology is that there's almost no actual archaeological evidence to support that whole idea. There is one or two... There's one or two temples in ancient India where you see a particular Buddhist temple with sort of inscriptions or shrines relating to some Mahayana deity or so on, and then later on Hindu inscriptions and so on within that same temple. Yeah? And it sort of got adapted from Buddhism to Hinduism within the same place. Yeah? So there's one or two places where that happens, but only one or two. And so there's very little evidence in the rest, direct evidence in the rest of Indian Buddhism, that there was an actual absorption of Buddhism into Hinduism as such.
But the absorption doesn't have to be that something turns from Buddhism to Hinduism. It just means that Buddhism sort of re-accepted so many Hindu concepts that were fought against by the Buddha that they were no longer distinguishable from Hinduism?
Yeah, yeah.
So, it's not that it becomes Hindu, but even if it's Buddhist, what's the difference?
But it is still distinguishable. I mean, if you look at a Buddhist temple and a Hindu shrine from the same period in India, you can very easily distinguish between them. Yeah? Having said which, exactly the same criticism was made by the Hindus. And they criticised Shankara, who was the greatest of all the Hindu philosophers, and they criticised him of being a secret Buddhist.
Yeah.
Guru Abhadha, they said, you're a secret Buddhist and you're smuggling into our Hinduism all these Buddhist ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you're talking about being able to distinguish from an architecture from a physical point of view, Buddhist ideas and stuff. But that doesn't mean necessarily the ideology and the ideas that were taught there or that were discussed there very much different than the
yeah.
You know, it's two very different things.
Partly, but you know, if we want to say that there's a merging. I don't want to dispute the fact that, you know, that there was an interaction and there was a melding. I just want to sort of question it. That's all. But you know, the reality is that it's very easy and very straightforward to distinguish a Buddhist shrine from a Hindu shrine in India in almost every case. And that even within the texts themselves, Shankara on the one hand is accused of being a secret Buddhist. On the other hand, he's said to have wandered around India destroying all the Buddhists. with his debate, right? And you find the same thing from the Buddhist point of view, that people will adopt ideas from Hindu philosophers and so on, but will also be very critical of them. So it's not like just a one-way thing. So, yeah. So I might just, it's nearly 6 o'clock, I might just finish this end, this little bit on the Tathagatagarbha thought, and we can continue with this next week. The actual seeing and knowing of this Buddha essence, or Dharmakaya, is said to usher in nirvanic liberation. This Buddha essence or Buddha nature is stated to be found in every single person, ghost, god, and sentient being. In the Buddha Nature Sutras, the Buddha is portrayed as describing the Buddha essence as uncreated, deathless, and ultimately beyond rational grasping or conceptualization. And yet it is already this already real and present, hidden internal element of awakeness, which, according to the Buddha Nature Sutras, prompts beings to seek liberation from worldly suffering and enables them to attain the spotless bliss which lies at the heart of their being. Remember that all of this, it all sounds very metaphysical and so on, but the ultimate thing that it's pointing to is the fact that inside of us we all have consciousness. That's what the awakeness is. We're actually all have some awareness. And at the essence, that's what Buddhahood is. Buddhahood just means you're awake, you're aware. And so I'm saying that all creatures have the essence of Buddhahood. Ultimately, it comes down to you all have some, as it says, awakeness or awareness. It's all something that everyone, all creatures, all beings. Once the veils of negative thoughts, feelings, and unwholesome action, the kleshas, have been eliminated from the mind and character, the indwelling Buddha principle, or Buddha Dhatu, is enabled to shine forth unimpededly and to transform the seer of it into a Buddha. Prior to the period of these suttas, Mahayana metaphysics had been dominated by teachings on emptiness in the form of Madhyamaka philosophy, and this is the Prajnaparamita literature. The language used by this approach is primarily negative. And the Buddha nature genre of sutras can be seen as an attempt to state orthodox Buddha's teachings of dependent origination and on the mysterious reality of nirvana, using positive language instead to prevent people from being turned away from Buddhism by a false impression of nihilism. Okay? So this is that interpretation, like say Yin Shun's interpretation, is that it's a skillful means of presenting Buddhism. In these sutras, the perfection of the wisdom of not self is stated to be the true self. The ultimate goal of the path is then characterized using a range of positive language that had been used in Indian philosophy previously by essentialist philosophers, but which was now transmuted into a new Buddhist vocabulary to describe a being who has successfully completed the Buddhist path. Right. So, can be seen in both of those ways. And these two forms of presentation of the teachings, the negative, the Nastika and the positive Astika teachings, and this is found also in the Brahmanical traditions, that you can express the same thing as Yajnavalkya, for example, expressed a neti, neti, not that, not that. And then the other way is by affirming, by saying this, thou art that, thou art that.
The previous passage reminded me of the Vayana concept, just a change from a non-self into something, some way of self.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, you know, to what extent is it just playing with words, or are you actually talking about something else? Yeah. So an exegetical treatise on Buddha nature is the Uttara Tantra. Again, this is a very late development. We're talking 5th, 6th, 7th centuries here, which sees Buddha nature not as that which is caused and conditioned, sanskrita, but as that which is eternal, uncaused, unconditioned, and incapable of being destroyed, although temporarily concealed within worldly beings by adventitious defilements. According to Buddhist scholar C.D. Sebastian, the Uttara Tantra's reference to a transcendental self, Atma Paramita, should be understood as the unique essence of the universe, thus the universal and immanent essence of Buddha nature is the same throughout time and space. So again, this particular expression can also be seen as again you can connect this to early Mahayana teachings. For example, the presence of Buddha nature throughout time and space is essentially what Amitabha, the idea of Amitabha, is. Amitabha has two names: Amitayus, which is infinite life, right? So it's like the Buddhahood expressed throughout the eternity of time, and also Amitabha, like infinite radiance. So his light sort of spreads out also through the entire universe. So it's like a Buddha which has been made infinite in time and space, is essentially what the idea of Amitabha Buddha, and actually they often abbreviate it to Amitabha Buddha, which just means infinite Buddha. And but that itself harks back to the idea you find in the original suttas, which is that the Dhamma is basically present there in through all of time and space. Wherever you are, whatever place you are, the Dhamma is there and the Dhamma is present. And it's just up for us to realize that. So there's, even, you know, when you look at these teachings, you take them abstract and you look at them by themselves, it looks like it's gone such a long way. But when you look at it through history, you can see all this, there's actually a train of connection there. And you can understand why they choose to express things in that particular way. Okay, so that's probably enough for this afternoon, and next week we can continue on discussion of Mahayana.